They're trying to help him, but they figured if they help him, everybody else.
Oh, gosh, just think you lose everything.
He must have known he had to pay taxes on it.
Well, good morning, folks. Maybe we could begin if you'd like to be seated and feel free to take a seat at the front if you like, but if you prefer the back, that's okay too. Yeah. Well, I'd like to welcome you this morning. My name is Tom Berger, and this is the Alaska Native Review Commission. And maybe I could start by telling you a little bit about what we're doing and why we're here. I'm glad to see all of you here, and I hope we'll have a useful morning and afternoon. We're going to be holding a hearing this morning, and then this afternoon, and then again this evening, and then Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon. So we are glad to see you all here. Well, I've been asked to conduct a review of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. And that act, known as ANCSA, is an act that attracted worldwide attention at the time and was hailed as the most generous settlement that had ever been made with Native Americans or Native people anywhere. And all of that happened back in 1971. Senator Henry Jackson of Washington was one of the principal architects of the act. And we're now taking a look, 14 years later, 1985, to see how it all worked out. What are the good things? What are the bad things? You know that 12 regional corporations were established in Alaska, and a 13th corporation headquartered here in Seattle. You know that 200 village corporations were set up in Alaska. Congress seemed to think that the idea was that these corporations, these Native corporations, in which I'm sure all of you hold shares in one way or another, that these Native corporations would go into business and would employ Native people and would make a profit and pay dividends to their shareholders. And in that way, Alaska Natives would become part of the mainstream of American business, of American capitalism. And I've been traveling now in Alaska for over a year, and I've been holding hearings in villages in every region of Alaska. I've been to 60 villages in every region of Alaska. I've held hearings throughout the state, and more than 1,400 Alaska Natives and other Alaskans have testified about the Claims Act. And it's no secret, I suppose, that they're very unhappy with it. They feel it didn't live up to the promise that was held out in 1971. And so we've been hearing testimony about the Claims Act, how it worked out, what's likely to happen now and in the immediate future, and where do we go from here. Now, wherever we went, certainly when we were in the Sea Alaska region, people said, well, we've got a lot of shareholders down in Seattle. You should go down and hear what they've got to say. In the Chugach region, people said, well, some of our folks are down in Seattle. You better go down there and hear what they've got to say. Same thing in Bristol Bay and in the Aleutians. And then, of course, we heard about the 13th Corporation, and we thought, well, we'd better come down and hear what happened with the 13th Corporation, and maybe some of you can tell us about that. And maybe some of you can tell us if you belong to Sea Alaska or any of these other regional corporations, how that has worked out. And if you belong to any of the village corporations in Alaska, you can tell us your views. Now, the settlement was one that provided that Alaska Natives would receive $962.5 million in 44 million acres of land. But the money and the land did not go to them as individuals. A very small distribution of money did in the first instance, but virtually all the money and all of the land went to the corporations. And Alaska Natives were made shareholders in the corporations, but the corporations received the money to go into business, and they received the land, the 44 million acres. And the reason why people are concerned today in Alaska is because they feel that the that Native ownership of that 44 million acres is threatened. And there are a number of threats, but there seem to be three principal threats, three principal dangers to continued Native ownership of the land. The first is corporate failure, bankruptcy. If a Native corporation fails, if it goes bankrupt, then its creditors can take its assets. And of course, for most of the village corporations, their principal asset is the Native land, the ancestral lands that were received under the settlement. So if these corporations go bankrupt, Native people could lose their land. There's a second danger, and that relates to 1991. Congress provided that that only Native people could be shareholders, or at least only Native shareholders could vote their shares for 20 years, so that on January 1st, 1992, the shares that Native people hold in these corporations can be bought and sold. They can go on the market, and that means that these corporations can be the subject of takeover bids. And people are very concerned about that. When you consider that takeover bids are a way of life in corporate America, Gulf Oil was the subject of a takeover bid last year, you can see that a village corporation on the shores of the Bering Sea with 100 shareholders may be vulnerable. Perhaps one of these regional corporations would be vulnerable to a takeover bid. And of course, because the settlement provided that all the Native ancestral land would be a corporate asset, That means that if a corporation is taken over in 1992 by outside interests, then the native land will no longer be native land. That's a second way in which people can lose their land. And there's a third way in which people can lose their land. I'm kind of reporting to you on what people have told me in Alaska. I want to hear what you've got to say, but I'll tell you a little bit about what I've heard there, because I know it must be of interest to you. The third danger to native land in Alaska is this. The state of Alaska gets about 85% of its revenue from oil, and about 90% of that oil revenue comes from one oil field, Prudhoe Bay. And all the predictions are that revenue from Prudhoe Bay will decline in the 1990s. And that means that the state of Alaska may well be looking for other sources of revenue. Now, Native corporations own 44 million acres, most of it in rural Alaska, and they are the largest landowners by far in rural Alaska. In fact, they may well be the largest landowners in America, private landowners. And that means that that land, under the Claims Act, 20 years after they receive their land, that land can be taxed, even if it is simply used for hunting and fishing and trapping, even if it's used only for subsistence, even if it doesn't generate any revenue, it can in the 1990s be taxed by the state of Alaska or under state authority. And if the revenues of the state of Alaska in the 1990s are in decline and they decide to impose even a nominal tax on native land in rural Alaska, let us say 25 cents an acre, that would require Alaska Native corporations to raise, even to pay a 25 cent an acre tax, they'd have to raise $11 million annually, and some of the village corporations, some of the regional corporations wouldn't be able to do it, and the state in that way would be able to take their land in default of payment of taxes, and they'd lose their land that way. Those are three real dangers that Native people in Alaska feel they are facing and are concerned about. Now then, I'm here because I'd like to know how you feel about all of these things. How did the settlement work out? If you're a shareholder, have you received dividends? If you were a shareholder, did you get a job from one of the corporations or from the 13th Corporation in particular? I don't suppose it's fair to expect that you would have gotten a job with one of the corporations in Alaska since you're resident here, but you might tell me what your experience has been with the 13th Corporation. Have you had any dividends? I'd like to know about that. Then there's the question of 1991 and the sale of shares. And this is a question on which I'd certainly like to hear what you've got to say. The way Congress set this up, you can't sell your shares now. But in 1992, you will be able to sell your shares. Well, in Alaska, at the meetings we've held, people have been urging a number of things. Some of us have said, well, let us sell our shares in 1992. Some have said we didn't get anything out of this settlement. So let us sell our shares. Let us sell them, and if somebody will buy them, then we'll get some money out of this, and that's what we want. Then we can buy a snow machine or a house or whatever. Now, all of this would, of course, depend on what the shares might be worth, but that's the view of some people. In Alaska, I would say the majority, undoubtedly the majority, of people who've testified at our hearings have said, no, we don't want the shares to be sold to all comers. We think there should be restrictions on the sale of shares because if the shares are for sale to all comers, then our corporations will be taken over and they won't be native corporations and the land won't be native land anymore. So they say, as some people have said, we shouldn't be allowed to sell our shares at all. Now that means that people wouldn't be able to cash in their shares in 1992. Then there's a kind of a compromise position in the middle. Some people have said, well, let's sell our shares, but let's provide that we can only sell them back to our own corporation. So our corporation can buy up our shares, and that way we'll get some money out of this, but the shares won't be distributed all over the United States and picked up by all kinds of non-native interests that don't have the welfare of Alaska Natives at heart. So that's another proposition. And I'd like to know what you feel about all this. You live down here in Seattle, and your views may be quite different from those we've heard of from Alaska Natives in Alaska itself. Then there's the question of the children born since 1971. The only people who received shares under the settlement were the Native people alive on December 18th, 1971. So that after midnight, maybe at 12:01 on December 19th, 71, a Native child was born, but too late. That child and all those born since have no right to be enrolled as shareholders. So one of the concerns of Alaska Natives has been, shouldn't these children born since 1971 participate in the settlement? Shouldn't they be enrolled as shareholders? Shouldn't they have some right to participate? And others have said, well, no, if they are given shares, these children, that'll dilute the value of our shares, so don't give them any shares. Others have said, no, they're part of us, they're part of the family, part of the village, they're Alaska Natives, they should be participants, even if it means we simply have to give them shares for nothing. Well, those are some of the things that people are talking about. Then I should mention that some people have said, look, if our concern is the land, maybe the best way to handle this is to transfer the land from the corporations to tribal governments, IRA governments, or to traditional councils. And that way the land will be safe under the jurisdiction of our tribal governments, and it can't be lost through bankruptcy, can't be the subject of a corporate takeover, and can't be taxed. And that's one of the alternatives that a lot of people in the Alaska villages have talked about. Well, let me just conclude before I invite you to give me your views. Let me just conclude by saying that I'm not here representing the government of the United States of America, and I'm not here representing the state of Alaska. They didn't ask me to do this job. I was asked to do this commission by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, which is an international organization of Eskimos from Alaska, Canada, and Greenland, and by the World Council of Indigenous People, which is an international organization of Native peoples in North and South America and other countries. And my job is to hold hearings, and I've held 60 hearings in Alaska, and I've finished my hearings in Alaska. I've been to every region, to 60 villages, heard 1,400 witnesses, and we are here in Seattle for 2 days to make sure that if the Alaska Natives living in Seattle have evidence to give, that we hear it today and tomorrow. I'm going to write a report about the Claims Act, how it worked out, the good side and the bad side. I'm going to indicate the views of Alaska Natives, how they feel about the Act, the present problems, and I'll make recommendations about what ought to be done. And those, I'll make recommendations not only for Alaska Natives, but for Native people and their governments in other countries. Because in other countries, Native people are settling their land claims and they want to know how this Alaskan settlement worked out. They heard a lot in 1971 about Alaska Natives getting all this money, becoming instant millionaires. Well, what happened to all those millionaires? So those folks in other countries are eager to know what the good things are about it and what the bad things are, so they can learn from the things that were achieved and learn from the mistakes that were made. The report that I write will be ready in September, and it will be submitted to the United Nations, but I will also be sending it to every village and regional corporation in Alaska, every IRA government, every traditional council, and I'll be sending it as well to all the people who have testified. And for that reason, if you testify today, we would like you to give us not only your name, but also your address here in Seattle so that we can send you a copy of the report in September when it comes out. And I hope that report will be helpful to Alaska Natives in deciding what their future course will be regarding the Claims Act. Everything that is said is being taken down by the tape machine here and is being transcribed, so there's a complete record of everything that is said at these hearings, and my report will be based on that record and what people have told me, and it will reflect what people have told me at these hearings. And I hope that my report will be helpful to Alaska Natives, whether in Alaska or in Seattle, in deciding what to do about the future of the settlement. So that's all I have got to say. I should add that we have, as well as holding hearings in Alaska, we have held roundtable discussions, public roundtable discussions in Anchorage, and have invited prominent Native leaders and lawyers and scholars to participate. And we have had a number of those, and indeed, Fred Paul, who's here today, came up last year and participated in one of those roundtable discussions, and we've learned a lot from those. Well, we're ready to begin if you'd... Yeah, well, yeah, when you testify, if you wouldn't mind coming up and sitting here at this chair, so that you can speak into this mic. If you'd rather stand and speak at that microphone there, that's fine. This is quite informal, and you know, you don't need anything written. Just tell me what's on your mind and how you feel about these issues. And if you would also give us your address along with your name so that we can send you a copy of the report in September, we'd sure appreciate that. So we're ready to for business, and if anybody would like to begin, I've said about all I'm going to say, and you come up here or speak at that microphone. Yes, Mr. Paul.
I'd like to say something.
Please do.
My name is Frederick Paul. 6815 31st Avenue Northeast, Seattle, 98115. I'd like to talk first about the size of the settlement. There's been a lot of complaint about we didn't get enough, and I agree with those thoughts. But I wanted to explain for the record the atmosphere that pervaded Congress from 66, when this movement really got underway, through the enactment on December 18th. That in turn is based upon what is known as the Teton case. I am a son of the Teton tribe of Tlingit Indians. In 1947, Congress took away the timber rights of the Southeast Indians, and the proceeds of sale would go into an escrow fund, according to the statute. So my father said, Congress can't do that. Or if it were to do that, we would be entitled to the stumpage. After all, Aboriginal rights are protected by the United States Constitution. So we sued for the money, and I participated in that lawsuit. And in 1955, the Supreme Court rendered its decision, the impact of which is that Congress can do whatever it wants to with Aboriginal rights. It can deprive the Indians of anything and everything. It can pay them a little bit or its real value. But whatever is paid is a gratuity, a gift. The vote was 5-3. I like to compare what the Supreme Court authorized with what some might say a grotesque comparison. When Hitler invaded the countries surrounding Germany, he did not deprive the people there, the farmers and the shopkeepers and the homeowners, of their land, except for the Jews. There are minor exceptions, but by and large, everybody maintained their own property. Justice Stanley Reed, in writing the opinion in the Teton case, said every schoolboy knows that the United States just moved westward and took the Indians' lands. Oh yeah, they had a few treaties and gave them a few trinkets, but actually it was conquest by war. And that's exactly what Hitler did to the Jews. Conquest by war. But the philosophy of the Teton case pervaded the halls of Congress. Congress can do as it pleases. Indians have no rights at all. The only strength we had in bargaining back there is that the Teton case also said that nobody else could invade Indian lands, Aboriginal right lands. In other words, if the state of Alaska wanted to take lands, or the oil company wanted to take lands, or the Secretary of the Interior wanted to take lands, the courts of the United States would protect Aboriginal rights. But Congress could do as it pleased. So that with that little bit of bargaining strength is what is one reason why we got what we got. The Teton case also put fear in us because Congress could do as it pleased. It didn't have to pay us a penny. And with the oil on the North Slope and the demands of national defense, Congress was going to do something. It was essential that the defense of the United States and the oil companies for their own personal profit there was going to be a settlement whether we liked it or not. Now, I want to change the subject a little bit to drafting. The Settlement Act was drafted principally by a man by the name of Louis Sigler, S-I-G-L-E-R. He had come over from the Department of the Interior. He's one of their lawyers. And joined the staff of the House Committee on Interior. Sigler was, by personal inclination, totally anti-Indian. As a matter of fact, traditionally, the Department of the Interior was anti-Indian, even though the BIA was one of its largest bureaus. But you've got oil under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of the Department of the Interior, you've got Fish and Wildlife Service, you've got the Great Environmental Bureau, you've got all kinds of things within the Department of the Interior which dominate it. And Sigler had that personal philosophy. So that here he was, the lawyer for the Committee of on Interior and on the House side. The drafting of the bill is just a hodgepodge. The Congress tried to solve the environmental problems and Indian rights and international problems in the Settlement Act. The drafting produced quarrels among so many different entities. I made an estimate of the amount of attorney's fees that have been paid by the various corporations, native corporations. This is as of 2 or 3 years ago. And it exceeds $200 million. The native corporations had to sue each other because they had boundary problems. And then some of the corporate managers thought the corporation was their personal empire, and so the dissident stockholders sued management. There was a merger problem at Kodiak. Then there were solvency problems where Business Alaska took advantage of some of the corporations. My estimate is realistic because I know from my own personal knowledge that several of the village corporations have paid more than $1 million in attorney's fees. That doesn't include the regionals. It doesn't even include the 13th with its terrible problems. And one of the major reasons for this litigation and these lawyers' fees is the drafting by the powers that be back in Washington, D.C. The lawyers' fees were so scandalous that in one of the cases that the district judge at Alaska commented on it that it is just a disgrace. Now, I'm a lawyer. I have a great pride in being a lawyer. But I'm also saying that a lot of the wasted money through this fruitless litigation is a direct product of the Congress. It was the incompetence of the Congress, if you please. Now, one final thought on the drafting of the settlement itself is that in today's world, we've got to have lawyers. The Department of the Interior did its best to prevent the native groups in the lobbying effort to have lawyers. There isn't a white man's corporation in the world who doesn't have a lawyer sitting at his elbow. In Washington, D.C., the American Petroleum Institute has a dozen lawyers, on and on and on. The Chamber of Commerce never goes to Washington without a lawyer. But none of us had a firm contract approved by the Secretary of the Interior as required by law. If we did have an approved contract, the Secretary did his best to find ways to disapprove it. That meant that the natives in their lobbying effort did not have a trained professional spokesman. It was an inhibition on their right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And it's really scandalous the way the natives were circumscribed in that regard. I want to reiterate, Mr. Commissioner, that I delivered a copy of my manuscript into my fee application, and you are authorized to draw on that for as you please. I could talk about this thing forever. I have one final thought. I have long been a proponent of the IRA system in the management of the yield of the settlement. During the settlement effort, I proposed that the IRA be utilized as the vehicle rather than these corporations. I didn't get a single native leader to support me, not one. Well, okay, now we got these native corporations. It is still possible to utilize, to a large extent, the IRA entity, sister legal entity, for the management of the yield of the money. It doesn't have to be everything going into from the corporation to the IRA entity. It can be, you can baby up into it. You can lease the ground rental to the IRA, which in turn can build a building, but the building would be under the control of the IRA. I remember one of the prominent native leaders saying, I'm not going to exchange one set of problems for a different set. Well, he has a point, but if you ease into it and have most of your business activities conducted by the IRA, you're going to survive the constitutional arguments about changing control. There has to be some good faith bargaining between the two entities. And you're also going to make it unattractive for a corporate takeover. If, and some of these corporations are pretty valuable. Some of the Southeast corporations with their timber rights are hugely valuable. Timber rights are everlasting. If the corporations can make a takeover uninviting, that is, if most of the activities are conducted through an IRA, you're going to prevent, make it difficult for a takeover to take place. I do fear corporate takeovers. You do not need 51% of the stock in order to control a corporation. Good old John Barleycorn's going to have his role in acquiring the stock of these shares of stock. And if you can get 5, 10, 15% and hire some solicitors the way the corporations are doing now, you're going to get substantial control. I thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Paul, and thank you for coming today. Sure. Yes, sir.
My name is Robert Peel, and I live at 10032 12th Northwest, 98117. It's a zip code. And I'm from the Haida Corporation, and I feel nervous up here, but about speaking up about Heidelberg Corporation, I feel that the only thing that came of it so far is that we're being divided, and I don't like it. And there's a majority of us young people that go around from Heidelberg and with the I don't care attitude, and I encourage young people to speak up at home and down here in Seattle, because it's just like there's a few of our people in there for money. We're being taken. I had one job from the Haida Corporation that was for 10 days. I look, I'm qualified in a few good jobs, and I'm willing to try anything, but I only had one job, and they paid $100 a day, and I have three kids to feed, and still today they're trying to decide how they can save Heidelberg. We have six more years before 1991, and I personally see nothing to come of Heidelberg. I feel that way, that we're lost because we have family struggles. We have three big families in Heidelberg, maybe two big families, and when one gets power, we lose. We're going to continue losing, and to me, I look into it, and I want people to hear and know it because I see it and I live it. Since I was a young guy, I watched it and I felt it, and I live it every day wondering what I can do to secure my future for my daughter and my boys. What can we do? I had a talk to some board of directors from home last night. They called me up. I've been trying to get things to try to understand them, what's going on. Why are we troubled so much with money? Money is dividing our village, and I've been to a few other small villages, and it's the same way. I don't see any good of it coming in our people, and we're being divided, you know, and they throw big parties for wherever they have meetings. That's what I've been seeing in my life. And I hear that in our village, you know, everything's closing down. They move a lot of outsiders to work in our village, and that leaves unemployment in our village at a high level that I don't even like, because I know the feeling of being unemployed and to look at our people wondering when they're going to be called to work, and you have jobs at landscaping for around the village. We could have did that ourselves, but they give the money to outsiders, and it's happening in the logging industry. They build roads around us, and here we sit in houses that were built from Tlingit Haida. Are they going to be there in 1991? To me, I don't think so. The way they build them of cheaply materials, and that's pretty sad to see. And I used to live in a low-income housing when I first got married, and it reminded me, I was so happy to move up to a good home. But those homes in all those little villages remind me of low-income housing, and it's a sad thing because they charge so much for them. They're overly charged. Most of those homes average in the $50,000 to $60,000. In the end of 10 years or whatever, they're going to sign them over, and those people are going to have nothing, no equity or nothing in it. And they don't realize things like that. In Heidelberg, they turned over the land so that they could build those houses on them. And most of those houses are built in swampy places. And people have to look at things like that. And I feel like in Heidelberg, that the board of directors are responsible. Somebody got to be responsible for our land and money. They're trying to get a land exchange now. It's been going on for the last 3 years. No movement. We got a lot of water rights, a lot of stumpage rights, but we don't have it. We have nothing to work with. And they declare bankruptcy, we're going to have nothing. It's going to take another few years to get on our feet. And in 6 years, if they couldn't do it in 12 years or whatever, how are they going to save it in 6 years? That's frightening. A lot of times I don't write things down. I've been living this. It's like going into the fog without a compass to me. I've been on a boat many, many years, and this is scary to me because it's 6 years coming down the line, and we're all in this together. And one thing that makes my heart sad is that we have many, many older people participating in all these meetings, in the young people, you know, you hear them on the outside, but you don't see them in the meeting speaking up, and we need it. We need something to change this around. And I feel like in Heidelberg we're misrepresented. You know, we're not spoken for, we're forgotten. There's probably about 100 shareholders from Heidelberg that live in here, down here in the Seattle area, and they don't talk to us. They don't even communicate to us as a whole. Every corporation is getting the same way. I've seen it, I lived it. And I have a lot of friends from throughout Alaska that are living through the same hardship as that. The direction, there's no direction that we can see. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. And myself, I'd like to see it change some way where, like, if the board of directors are not funneling our land right, are using it right to benefit us, they should be let go. Because I feel like if they declare bankruptcy, everybody's going to be, they're protected by law some way, and we're the ones that are going to pay for it. If we don't have it, are we going to owe the government if we say they went bankrupt now? Are we going to owe the government if we go in the hole? There's such a thing, and people aren't looking forward to things like that. And I am. I'm thinking, what can I do getting involved in Heidelberg? How can we help our own people? Because right now we're like this in Heidelberg. There's two families. One family has all the power. They have all the board of directors. Our family sits nil. They're trying to outdo each other. And every time I go home, even at church doings and stuff like that, I say, we gotta have unity, one, make one. And that means Tlingit Haida, the Eskimo, wherever we needed one, unity. And they got it now. We have 13 corporations and we're divided. That's where it started. They divided us, and that was, and we need all the people's support. The way I'm feeling now, I'm just thinking, I heard that you just